Has
Yeah.
there been any discussion already about what you have in mind for Go Solo?
Well, we decided, I think, that we want to keep it pretty close to, as all the other tracks do, we want to keep it pretty close to the way it's been recorded.
These guys are pretty smart, so they've got it arranged pretty well on the tape.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you can get songs that maybe you don't have too much idea how you want it to sound when the mix, so you leave a lot of things open on the tape and you maybe cut them out when you mix and stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Just listen to the solo on its own.
All right.
Okay.
Just one time.
Okay.
All right, here we go then.
Hugh Padgham, and this is my 80sography.
Welcome to the 80sography podcast and part two of the My 80sography Hugh Padgham interview. There's lots to enjoy here. I need to point out there's two quick fire rounds in this episode. The second one should be at the very end of the interview. I.e. in this instance should have been at the end of part four, but this was the end of the first interview I did with Hugh, and the second and third ones I kind of sorted out the audio on my side so my audio sounds better. So rather than cut this out and have sound discrepancies in episode four, I thought I'd just leave it at the end of this episode. So there's two quick fire rounds here. Anyway, enjoy.
Part two of the interview commences now.
1982.
Quick question. You produced Phil Collins' Frida from ABBA's first solo album. I have one specific question because Elvis Costello wrote a bunch of songs for this project that Phil Collins rejected. And I wonder if you heard the songs and you heard why they were rejected. Do you have any knowledge about that?
Well, now you mention it, it rings a bell. I was very much on Phil's sort of coattails, really, at that point. I mean, we had struck a really good relationship. I can't remember if I did Frida's record before Hello, I Must Be Going. Yes, because I've got May to September, Hello, I Must Be Going.
Phil Collins would have been afterwards.
Yeah. So Phil, having done Face Value, he suddenly got, oh, wow, I kind of quite like this producing idea. And so somehow Frida... We all loved ABBA. I still know very many musicians who, well, including myself, who use ABBA as a benchmark. So Phil basically, throughout his whole life, could never say no to anybody, whether it be doing stupid things or good things.
Can we just ask this question? Is there anything you remember him turning down?
No,
I don't. Literally, there can't be a single project where you're like, no.
No, he never turned down anything in his whole life, as I know. Anyway, so we ended up in Sweden doing this, and he just said, we had a great time doing Face Value and Genesis and stuff. So we were sort of, in terms of studio-wise, we were sort of joined at the hip. So he obviously asked me to go out and make the record with him, and it was a lot of fun. All people we knew playing the instrument and stuff. You know, basically Phil put together the band. Song-wise, I don't know. I can't really remember, and I can't really remember about Elvis Costello. It, from me, from a, I was amazed. I thought Frida would be a sort of almost a better lead singer than she was. It's that, you know, she does sound quite sort of, I don't know, nervous, I think, in a way. Right. Yeah, it was difficult. It was also the first album I ever recorded completely digitally on a digital multi-track, and it was very early days, and I'm amazed it actually sounds as good as it does, because it was a nightmare trying to make things sound good. After that record, I continued to work analog for several years to come. I must say it was good fun. We also did a couple, two if not three tracks with Adam and the Ants, which was basically just Adam and Marco Pironi. And we did them in Sweden as well, but I can't remember exactly when that was. It must have been.
That came out in 83, so I don't know if that was recorded in 83 or not.
Probably, it must have been. But yeah. I do remember doing that in Sweden as well at Polar Studios, which was owned by ABBA. It was a great studio. I love Sweden as well. My mother was Swedish, so I have a sort of built-in affinity.
Do you know any Swedish swear words?
No.
Ah.
The only Swedish I know is Jag talar inte svenska, which means I don't speak Swedish.
It's the one sentence you want if you're ever caught in Sweden, yeah? Yeah. You did engineering on The Dreaming for Kate Bush. How much tracks was it you worked on for that album?
Well, it was Sat in My Lap. Great song. Just did three songs, and I was really busy doing other things, and she was desperate for me to do some work with her, and so I said I can only do the weekends, and I can only do a few weekends. I spoke to Nick Launay the other day, who took over. He was my assistant on Face Value. He was really young, and we had both worked on Public Image and stuff like that in 79. And Kate liked what he had done with Public Image. And I said, I can only do these, it was three or four weekends. Okay, the songs that I did were Sat in My Lap, Leave It Open, and Get Out of My House.
Get Out of My House is quite an odd song, that one, isn't it?
Some of it I like, and some of it I don't really like.
So when you only work on some of the tracks, can you hear the difference between your tracks and the other tracks? Do they jump out at you in terms of, like,
songs? Not really, because all I did with Kate Bush was engineer the basic backing tracks. So I'd met her during Peter's record, and she was obviously impressed with the drum sound and this, that, and the other. So she was desperate to have me work with her on her record. And it was also the first record that she had produced herself, or was producing herself. And I said to her, look, I can't, I'm in the middle of doing. See, I think I was finishing off Abacab then. And then when I spoke to Nick Launay the other day, I was booked to go to Montserrat to do The Police, and she was wanting me to do the record with her, and I said I can only do these sessions, and she would go, oh, why, and she had this lovely squeaky voice. I mean, she was so gorgeous, Kate, but I didn't have the guts to tell her that I was going off to work with the police, if you see what I mean, because I didn't want to sort of feel like I was being rude, and I didn't. Yeah. And the thing is, she only wanted me to engineer the stuff, and I was like, you know, offered to produce with Ghost in the Machine. So it was kind of a no-brainer. So really, all I did was do the basic backing tracks, which was drums, bass, and maybe some bits and pieces. So I never did any of the vocals or any of the weird shit that, you know.
I'm trying to think. So Sat in Your Lap, is there the gated reverb on the drums on that?
No, not really. But if you listen to the intro of it, it's this guy called Preston Heyman was the drummer, and he was just sort of doing this rolling sound on the toms. Again, no cymbals, but you can hear, if you've got a keen ear, you can very much hear the sound of that room, the Stone Room at Townhouse Studio 2, is very apparent. And it is also on the other two songs I did. But that's that. Honestly, that's all I did with Kate. So I can't take any credit from other than doing that.
But it's another tick off the bucket list. You get to work with Kate Bush.
Oh yeah, no, that was great.
I didn't realise that you mixed H2O by Hall & Oates. So yeah. You mixed Man Eater and Family Man One on One. That's incredible. Like another massive, huge hit you involved in. So when you're mixing, when that's the role, you're brought in to mix the album. I assume everything's recorded and finished, and you're just doing the final layer, effectively. Yeah. So how does that work? Are you doing that in isolation? Are you giving notes? Do you sit with the producer and the artist to do that?
No. They were both there in the studio, Electric Lady Studios in New York. I was like a pig in shit because it was a famous studio. One of the first times that I'd worked properly in New York. And I met John Oates through a friend of mine who, strangely enough, ran a motor racing team, and John Oates was a very good athlete, and he was a good tennis player, and he was actually dabbled in motor racing as well. And so I was invited to go to a Hall & Oates gig in London by this motor racing friend of mine called Richard, and that's when I met John. And he obviously knew of my, you know, success and records I'd made. So I got sort of a call out of the blue, would you come and mix our new album? And so it was like, you know, no brainer really, wasn't it? And so I went over there, and I remember staying in Richard Branson owned a brownstone house in the Village, which wasn't far from the studio. And in those days, I still used to see Richard a bit, and I rang him up and said, can I stay in your house? And he said, yeah, sure. Anyway, so I'd walk every day from Richard's house to the studio, and that's where I mixed that whole album. And it was great. I loved it, and I thought it all sounded great. And they loved me because in Maneater, I'm mixing it, and it's got this sax solo thing that goes on, and I kept thinking, oh god, this doesn't sound very good, it's too much space, he hasn't sort of played enough in it. So I thought, well, I know what I'll do, I'll get a digital delay and I'll delay it so it repeats, fills up the holes that he hasn't played in.
Ah, so it kind of repeats, isn't it? Wow, that's amazing.
Thank you. that's an example of what sometimes a producer or whatever can bring to a mix as well. But obviously I was only mixing it, and that's...
Because from a layman's terms, the perception of mixing is that you're just balancing the instruments. You'll bring the bass up here, higher here, mix those drums down, lower there. So
yes, and also making the sound of them. You're changing the tone of the instruments and what sort of echo you put on the lead vocal. And, you know, I mean, mixing is an art unto itself. I mean, there's a lot of people who only mix records. Mm. I mean, the famous, most famous guy is Bob Clearmountain.
Bob Clearmountain, yeah.
And he pretty well has made his... I mean, he's a good sound recorder as well, but he's made his whole career out of mixing, that he is like still the go-to guy to have your record mixed. But I used to adore the fact of, I mean, 90% of the records I ever made, I saw from the beginning to the end, the mixing. And I prided myself on my engineering and mixing chops as well as producing. Because, I mean, when I started in this business, my, you know, right back in the beginning when I was 18, all I aspired to become was chief engineer at a top London studio. I never thought about the idea of ever being a producer. I mean, that just sort of came really from working at the townhouse and sort of falling into it almost. So I loved mixing records as well. Hall & Oates was great. I loved mixing that. They had some massive hits on it. So I was their best friend for a bit, for sure.
So when you're mixing, you're coming to do the mix, you're effectively doing a remix, because I assume the original producer would have done a mix that you're then...
Yeah, they're usually called rough mixes. So you've spent all your time recording and then doing overdubs, i.e. vocals and things like that, getting basically all the instrumentation and vocals on the multi-track tape. You're then taking all that stuff. Mixing is what it is. You're mixing 24 tracks or 48 tracks, or you've got down to two tracks, which is the stereo, which comes out of the speakers at the end of the day on either the radio or your record player at home or whatever. And so it's quite an art to get it all to sound good, like I said before, with good reverbs on it. And so it sounds great on small speakers as well as big speakers. And sometimes in those days, you would do special mixes for mono, because AM radio was still prevalent in those days and was mono, really. As you know, Radio 1 in this country was AM mono until... Mm-hmm. Not that long ago, really.
Yeah.
FM radio, when I first started going to LA and I would be driving around in my rent-a-car, I couldn't believe the sound of FM radio.
Mm.
The car stereos sounded great and FM radio sounded great.
Yeah. Okay, I'll briefly talk about... You did the 3x3 EP with Genesis, which was leftover songs from the ABBA Cab sessions that came out in 82.
Yes.
With the Paper Late single. Now, was this a leftover from the session, or was this recorded specially as a single?
No, I think it was a leftover.
I think it's a brilliant single. I love this. It's one of those songs when you listen to it, it kind of improves your mood by 8%. Do you know what I mean? It's like it just lifts you just hearing this like perfect 3-minute pop song.
Yeah, it is. It is good. I've got no memory of why it didn't get finished. It was probably something that's like ran out of time, or nobody wanted to write the lyric for it, or something.
But it's a top 10 hit, but it's often overlooked. No one ever really talks about it.
Was it really a top 10 hit?
You got to number 10, yeah.
Wow. I don't think I mixed any of that, the three live sides. I don't think I had anything to do with that, because the next time I met up with them was for Genesis, really, I think.
So mixing a live album then, is that kind of, you're just trying to capture the live feeling, or is it more complicated than that, and you're trying to enhance it as well, make it sound something you can listen to at home?
Well, I've mixed a few live albums in my time, and I love them because it's just, you know, it's live. Occasionally people, if there's a bad gloop on something, you know, or a really out of tune note or something. I mean, you know, you can go and sort of repair things a little bit, but generally speaking, yeah, it's all down to how well it was recorded live, really, to be honest. I like mixing live stuff because you're not producing an album, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to put together everything to do with mixing for me. And my whole raison d'etre in life, really, has been to try and have people remember my records as being sonically good. You know, nice, not nice, that's a horrible word, but just, you know, good quality sound.
Okay, in 82, two albums were released that you produced. There's English Settlement XTC, another really good album. Senses Working Overtime is a really special song to me. It's one of the first singles I ever bought.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely, it still sounds amazing today. Do you have any memories of the first time you heard that song and the recording of it?
Yeah, I do. I remember a lot about English Settlement, to be honest. It was, for me, a very happy time because we were all at the Manor. We worked very hard because when you worked at the Manor, which was this, what they called residential studio, you used to have to book it by the week. And so the week often to musicians meant 24/7, which meant people like me didn't get any sleep. But anyway, we were there and we did it over a couple of months. I was just knocked out with all the songs. It was before the time that Andy, I mean, before he literally stopped playing live. So even though it was obviously in his mind that he didn't want to, it wasn't official yet. So I remember just being knocked out with all the songs. I thought all the songs were amazing, Collins songs as well. I think there were some problems within Colin and Andy and their relationship.
So was he always only given a certain allotted number of songs per album, or was it a case that you'd look at the material and just happen to be like, okay, it's three or four good Colin Moulding songs, we'll include those?
I think everybody rocked up with their songs. Well, I say everybody, meaning Colin and Andy rocked up with their songs. They didn't write together. I mean, to a very small extent, Andy was probably a bit peeved because Colin's songs had been more of the hits, really.
Yes, Making Plans for Nigel and Generals and Majors.
And so on. And I think there was a bit of stress involved there because I do remember Colin, when he came to sort of do lead vocals on his songs, because you'd often do the backing tracks and then come back and redo the vocals separately. And I do remember Colin having a bit of problem singing, getting his sort of act together. But I sort of also remember him perhaps having a cold as well. But often in those days, you were quite pressurized to finish records by a certain time, you know, because of three things, really. Money, you know, it cost a lot to make records, touring, release dates. And often for me, I, you know, especially being so busy in those days, I was often contracted to go and work somewhere else on somebody else's record soon after. So there was often a lot of pressure to get it all finished. I just remember, you know, good things and good vibes about that whole album, I must say.
Was it always designed as a double album, or was that something just happened because there was so much material?
It's just because there was so much material. And I think, I can't remember if I mentioned before, but you know, we're still talking pre-CDs, and we didn't want more than 22, 23 minutes aside. So, you know, you could get up to 30 minutes aside, because Genesis records in the old days used to get up to 30 minutes aside, but they were quieter than other records and not as punchy sounding. So it was a no-brainer, really. But it was released as a single album in America. But I can't remember now, I haven't done my homework properly, which songs got left off in America.
10-track in America, wasn't it?
Yes.
So Senses Working Overtime, is there any particular memories about like working out an arrangement for the song, or because it's one of those perfectly structured pop songs that just gets better the more you get into the song?
Well, no, I mean,
like the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 break for the last chorus, doing, you know, there's that pause and then it goes into the chorus. It's like, was it always designed as part of the song?
Yeah, it was always arranged. I mean, Andy used to come in with the songs pretty well arranged. We didn't spend days working out arrangements in the studio. And all the mean, Andy, for me, is literally, definitely in my top most talented people I've ever worked with. I mean, he is just a legend to me. And, I've just got so... I feel sorry for him because he's never really been recognised in the way that I think he should be. I mean, I was talking to... He's actually an English guy, but he's a producer and lives in America and has done for 20 years. And we were discussing XTC the other day, and he said... Every person in America who's a muso, meaning a musician, a musician's musician, a muso, all absolutely rave about XTC.
And you also produced, of course, Phil Collins' second solo album, Hello, I Must Be Going. He must have felt pressure following up that huge first hit album. Did you feel the pressure as well going into that? Well, or was it more like you felt liberated by the success you've had?
Well, the thing is, I regarded Phil Collins' first album as not... When we were making it, I never remember thinking, oh, we're trying to make a commercial album here, because I just thought it was all really interesting songs that we got great people to play on, and looked at it again as a bit of a muso album, if you see what I mean. I know we did have success with it, but I don't think it sold 7 million or anything like that.
But it was 5 times platinum in the UK and in the US.
Okay, well, I didn't realise it was that much, but there you go.
Minor detail.
Well, yes, but I probably didn't know that detail, if you know what I mean. So, you know, we started off doing Hello, I Must Be Going, and, have you got it in front of you? What's the first track called?
I Don't Care Anymore. I think I Don't Care Anymore is probably my favourite Phil Collins song.
I love that song. And we actually did do that at the townhouse. I was just, if you listen to it really carefully, it's got the drums when they start are really sort of dry. And he used to play with these single-headed tom-toms, which is some of the sound that is... got on In the Air Tonight and stuff as well. The fact that it's got single heads, the tom sounds different to when it's got two heads, one on the top and one on the bottom. Anyway, I started off by miking the song starts off with the sound of the toms mic'd from actually inside the tom itself, which you can't do obviously if you've got two heads on it. And then as the song gets further and further along, so the sound becomes more and more open, and then it ends up being all...
Yeah, so that when the vocal comes in, the drum sound completely shifts.
Yeah. And so I was obsessed of sort of doing that sort of thing, you know, and just trying to do another great Phil Collins record. And in a way, it showed by the fact that the only real single off it in the end was the cover. Phil had this thing from face value that every album he said, I want to do a cover of. So obviously on the first album, it was the Beatles. And the second one, it was the Supremes, Diana Ross and the Supremes. And we had great fun, or I had great fun trying to recreate a Motown type sound, which we thought was perfectly all right to do because it was a male singing on it, not a female. So we were showing, what's the word, respect rather than trying to, because normally if you do a cover, you've got to do it in a way that's better than the original is what you always try and do. And better usually means completely different, or hopefully, you know, if you just try and copy the original thing, it's never going to be as good. But we thought we had credence to do that because it was Phil singing, not Diana Ross, if you see what I mean.
Obviously, as a 9-10 year old, this was the first time I heard the songs, and this was always the original to me.
Right.
The Supremes version is like this retro sounding cover or something, because that's You Can't Hurry Love to me, is Phil Collins.
Yeah, how funny. Yeah.
The other singles in the UK didn't do anything. I don't understand why I Don't Care Anymore wasn't released as a single in the UK. Because I know it wasn't in the US, but it wasn't in the UK, so I do not understand. So, like I said, I think it's his best song. I love a bit of pissed off Phil. I like him when he's pissed off.
No.
You know, it's great music when he's annoyed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And he has that very guttural sound. And that was sort of got through the sort of mic and compressor combination. You know, I was going on about compressors before.
Yeah.
And, he used to sing to that compressor. We had a special compressor. It was made by a company called Allen and Heath, who nobody usually used, but we sort of made it our own little thing. I do remember after that, you know, a year or two later, when we started doing No Jacket Required, being given a pep talk by Tony Smith, who's Phil's and Genesis's manager, saying, you know, if you're going to do a third solo album, can you please try and, you know, have a few hits on it, please, you know, given a bit of a pep talk before we start.
Okay. Well, you achieved your aim, I think it's fair to say.
Well, I guess, yes.
Pageant's Pick.
Okay, we'll take a break from the years now to do what I'd call Pageant's Picks.
Okay.
Where I basically give, ask you questions on your favourites of the 80s that you were involved in. Yeah. So yeah. The first one is your favourite album of the 80s that wasn't yours.
Well, it's so difficult, these questions. Yeah. But I think for me, it has to be the Talking Heads Remain in Light album.
And that's from 1980, isn't it? Yeah.
Just works, doesn't it? Softly, he glides along the streets and alleys. Up comes the wind that makes them run for cover. He feels the time is surely now or never more. The wind in my heart.
Did that influence any particular album you worked on?
No, I was just obsessed with Talking Heads. I just adored them and still do.
Did you ever get a chance to work with them or David Byrne?
No, I'm very sadly not. Steve Lillywhite and I tried to hatch a plan to see if we could find a way of working with them at one point, but it
never happened.
Sometimes you go, well, I don't want to work with my idols because I don't want to sort of find it disappointing in any way or something like that.
I think we're going to get to that. Your favourite film of the 80s?
It's got to be Blade Runner. David Bowie turned me on to Blade Runner.
Really?
Yeah, he did. And then, because it had come out the year before, I think I was working with him. And
yeah, the 82 that came out, yeah.
Thing is, when you're working in the studio, you tend to work, you know, quite long hours and most often evenings and stuff. So things like going to the cinema and theatre were quite rare occurrences, if you know what I mean. Anyway, when I went to see Blade Runner, it was like, oh my God, this is unbelievable.
You were made as well as we could make you, but not to last. The light that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And you have burned so very, very brightly, Roy. You're quite a prize.
I've done questionable things.
Also extraordinary things. Revel in your time.
Nothing the god of biomechanics wouldn't let you in heaven.
It's great choice. Okay, your favourite book of the 80s?
Oh, again, this was quite difficult, but I chose Perfume. You know Perfume? The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind.
And what was it about that book you liked?
It's just a mad story, isn't it? It's macabre, it's weird, it's surreal, it's everything. And I adore Perfume. I know it sounds really strange, this, but where I grew up, there was a perfume factory down the road. And I had this thing that I kind of thought I wanted to be a perfume inventor when I grew up.
So it's like the workers in a studio would be a perfume inventor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when the world would have been different if you'd have gone down that route. Imagine the perfumes you'd have invented, though. Imagine the reverb on those perfumes.
I know.
In 18th century France, there lived a man who was one of the most gifted and abominable personages in an era that knew no lack of gifted and abominable personages. His story will be told here. His name was Jean-Baptiste Grenouille, and if his name, in contrast to the names of other gifted abominations, de Sades, for instance, or Saint-Justs, Fouchés, Bonapartes, etc., has been forgotten today, it is certainly not because Grenouille fell short of those more famous blackguards when it came to arrogance, misanthropy, immorality, or, more succinctly, wickedness, but because his gifts and his sole ambition were restricted to a domain that leaves no traces in history, to the fleeting realm of scent.
Right, best TV program or series of the 80s?
Well, I think I've got to choose the two Ronnies.
Of course, Phil Collins was on that for a while, wasn't he? He did some sketches with them.
Oh, yeah, I think he did.
He was a tramp, wasn't he? I remember that, yeah.
But the two Ronnies was on a Saturday night. I mean, I never used to watch telly in the week. Yeah, I nearly chose Snooker.
For those of you in black and white, it's the green over that bottom pocket that he's looking at.
Because
you're so rock and roll, Hugh.
I know. I used to get home late at night, and the only thing that was on was Snooker. But I thought, I can't choose Snooker. It's got to be the two Ronnies.
Your chosen subject was answering questions before they were asked. This time, you have chosen to answer the question before last each time. Is that correct?
Charlie Smithers.
And your time starts now. What is paleontology?
Yes, absolutely correct.
What's the name of the directory that lists members of the peerage?
A Study of Old Fossils.
Who are Len Murray and Sir Geoffrey Howe?
Burks.
Correct. What is the difference between a donkey and an ass?
One's a trade union leader, the other's a member of the cabinet.
Okay, best live event you experienced in the 80s?
I've got a secret sort of thing that in the 70s and 80s, I really liked the genre that was called jazz rock. Things like Chick Corea. He had a band called Return to Forever. But the one who I was obsessed with, and I think really will be my main choice, because I used to see him pretty well every time he came to England to play, was Frank Zappa. I adored Frank Zappa's records.
Did he work with producers or did he self-produce all this stuff? So would you have the option to offer to work with him?
I met him once because he came into the townhouse to do something. I think it was only some editing or something, but he came into the townhouse and I made sure that I did meet him. I don't usually do that with famous people, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But no, Frank Zappa, he was somebody else. And I you know, his shows were just, you never knew what was going to happen. And they were just great. And the thing is, if you're a really, really good musician, you had two gigs that you wanted more than anything else. And one of them was playing in Miles Davis's band and the other was playing in Frank Zappa's band. And if you ever got the call, that was it. And he was vicious, Zappa, because I know a friend of mine, Vinnie Colaiuta, drummer, who was a fantastic drummer and worked with us with Sting for a long time. And he played with Frank for ages. And he said it was unbelievable because he was such an amazing musician that you'd tremble when you went to your, what's the word, audition and stuff. Mm. And he had this piece of music that was called The Black Page. And the reason it was called the Black Page was because it had so many dots on the music that it was almost impossible to sight read. And that was what you were normally given as your audition, whichever instrument you were playing. Anyway, apparently Vinny played it perfectly all the way through, and he was the first person ever to do that.
Last question. Song you wished you had produced in the 80s?
Well, yeah, I think this is a bit of a difficult one because I want to choose a song off Remain in Light. Am I allowed to do that?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, Once in a Lifetime.
And what would you have done differently?
Nothing.
It's the perfect record, yeah.
That's what I mean. I wished I'd produced it. It's just
right.
So perfect. When I heard it, and when I still hear it now, because I gave it a listen yesterday, because I was trying to. I mean, I've got one or two other songs that I wished I'd produced, but I think it's got to be Once in a Lifetime. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, I mean, I quite wished I'd produced Let's Dance by David Bowie, but I think Once in a Lifetime's better. And it's so difficult. I mean, I had literally hundreds of songs.
I think if you think about the gated reverb and then the drum sound on Let's Dance, they're two most influential drum sounds of the 80s.
Yeah.
So it kind of links those two.
1983.
Split Ends, you produced Conflicting Emotions. Neil Finn, I think, is an amazing songwriter. You've worked with some brilliant songwriters. I think Neil Finn's right up there. And
yeah.
Message to My Girl in particular is such a beautiful song.
I think so too, but I don't know how you know it because I don't think it ended up being released in England, did it?
Well, this is like being a big fan of Crowded House, kind of going backwards like you do. Like,
yeah.
So knowing Crowded House, and also there's a live version of that song. It was on one of their CD singles. That's how I discovered that song, and then heard the Split Ends version afterwards. But it's such a beautiful song. I don't want to say I want you, even though I want you so much. It's wrapped up in conversation, whispered in a hush. Though I'm frightened by the word, think it's time that it was heard. No more empties and a possession. Vision swept under the bed. It's no New Year's resolution. It's for the bad. Do you remember the first time you heard that song and the songs he was writing at that time? What was it like working with Neil Finn?
Well, I knew them quite well by that time because I originally met them when I was working for Virgin and they came in to do an album at the Manor. They were quite well known because they'd had a couple of hits. They were signed to A&M and they had gone from living in England back to, not back, they'd gone to Australia because obviously they were from New Zealand and they were living there. And they came over and made this album with this American producer called Mallory Earle. I don't know why I remember it so well. Anyway, Mallory was the producer and he was also fancied himself as an engineer. And it was the most terrible sounding record ever. I mean, it was like so bad, it wasn't true. And so I got really friendly with them. I mean, I was sort of almost like a sort of this must have been in 78 or early 79, I suppose, when I was still engineering. And so I wasn't really, Mallory wouldn't let me engineer, and this record was terrible. Became great friends with the bands, and we stayed friends. And so when it came to do Time and Tide, which was in 1981, they asked me, and I went to Australia because they were living in Australia then. And that did quite well. We had a hit on that song called 6 Months in a Leaky Boat, but unfortunately it coincided with the Falklands War.
Yes, it's bound, isn't it?
He was about to sail, so that was a bit of a no-no. Anyway, I went back to do Conflicting Emotions a couple of years later. And it was quite a difficult record to make because I think Tim Finn and Neil Finn were beginning to sort of, I don't know, I mean, they got this incredible Catholic brotherly love, which is intense. But there was still the feeling that I think possibly that Neil was taking over from Tim in a way. I don't.
Well, was it a case that Tim was more kind of taking a back seat and looking for a solo career at this stage? So Neil kind of took
I think
over.
Partly as well. It was definitely, it felt like a last album in a way. And I remember the vibe with, I mean, Noel, the drummer, was always lovely, but Griggsy, we used to call him,
right.
Nigel. He was being a bit weird, but Eddie Rayner, the keyboard player, he was great. We stayed great friends. I went back to Australia and mixed an album he did with his next band. But for me, they, from that era, Split Enz and XTC were the most unbelievably talented bands. You know, the Finn brothers were just incredible writers. And obviously Neil went on to have the most amazing career. And one of the worst decisions I ever made in my life was after Conflicting Emotions, Neil came to England and he came over to my house and played me some demos for his new band. And well, all I can say is Don't Dream It's Over wasn't on those demos.
Okay. Right. If it had, that's In the Air Tonight being played to Genesis all over again, isn't it?
Yeah. If I'm perfectly honest, I wasn't so impressed, but I absolutely think it's my fault, although my excuse is that a couple of those hits weren't on that lot of demos. I didn't exactly pass, but I think I probably didn't sort of, I didn't go, oh my God, this is absolutely incredible, which is normally what an artist is looking for,
yeah,
for a producer, if you see what I mean.
And I guess at this time you were lined up for Bowie, were you? This had been.
Oh, I can't remember exactly when it was. Yeah, it probably was around there. Well, hang on. 83 was Conflicting Emotions, wasn't it?
Yeah, end of 83 it's released.
Oh, well, it probably wasn't. When was the first Crowded House album released then?
That was 86.
Okay, well, it would have been, I would have thought, 85 then, to be honest.
Right, so it might be McCartney you're working with at the time then.
No, oh, yeah, don't.
Right, okay.
That's probably why I was in a bad mood.
Okay, we'll get to that. Right, so in 83, we're back to the Genesis and the Police again, working with both of them again. In terms of the two groups, perceptions, they're very different, but is there any way in which those two groups are similar? Or how are they most similar and how are they most different as groups to work with?
They're most similar because there's three people in the band and that's about it. They're most different from every other possible angle, but obviously both brilliant bands, you know. I mean, see, I don't kid you or anybody else, and it's well documented that Synchronicity was a hard record to make, and you know, when people say, oh, it must be great fun being a record producer and all that, which it is, but it's not to say that every day is, you know, Christmas Day, so to speak. And
I would assume, looking from the outside in, that Synchronicity would have been a nightmare to make. And their relationship completely deteriorated by this point. Well, there's a story you often hear that Stuart Copeland told about that he'd go in and record a drum part, then Sting would come in later, say, I don't like that, scrub it, and they'd be back to square one. And this is constantly happening. Is that an exaggeration, or was it like that?
No, there is a particular instance of that which I can describe if you like.
Yes, please, yes.
But just before we do that, when we started the record, they were at loggerheads. And the fact that I described from the first conversation about Ghost in the Machine that they were in separate rooms was actually a good thing, because we repeated that way of recording on Synchronicity. But we actually had, after 2 weeks of recording, so we go out to Montserrat and you've got this lovely studio and sun is shining and whatever. And after 2 weeks, we did not have one song that, if you had come to the studio, or could have played you, not even a backing track. It was all just disastrous. It just either wasn't working or trying different versions of songs. We had nothing. And it got to the stage where, quite why we had nothing, I really don't know, but it was just difficult and we had nothing. And it was so nothing that there was a call for Miles Copeland, the manager, to come out to the studio and have a meeting and sort out what's going on. And for Miles to leave either London or New York to come to an equivalent of a desert island in the Caribbean was something. Like, Miles did not like Montserrat at all. And so he never would come unless he had to. So anyway, he came. And I always remember us having a meeting around, just outside of the studio was a swimming pool. We all sat around the swimming pool, the three guys in the band and me. And we had a discussion. And the end of the discussion was, we either make a go of it and try and be civil and get on and make an album, or we just quit right now. So there will not be a fifth Police album. And so luckily it was like, well, let's get on with it then. So then we got on with it, and by hook or by crook, it ended up how it ended up. And I think a lot of the vibe of the album, particularly the two Synchronicity tracks, comes out of the anger. I mean, it's just got something about that record, don't you think? It's got
Synchronicity too, especially. I was going to ask you about that. Just the energy of that song. There's just such a rage to it. It's just incredible.
It's incredible. I mean, Stuart is the most brilliant drummer. I mean, there's no question about it. And you know, I can just feel his anger when he's playing. And when he was playing in this. Dining room, and it was hot. It was no air conditioning, obviously, because it was half outside. And so you'd get halfway through a track and the drumsticks would fly out of his hands because he was so sweaty. And he ended up actually using gaffer tape to gaffer his sticks in. And a lot of those tracks I had to make up out of, which was a very usual thing to do in those days, is you edit takes. So you might do, say, three takes or five takes of Synchronicity 2, and you listen back to them and you go, oh, wow, the end of take three is amazing, but the beginning of take five is much better. And so you would edit the beginning of take five to the end of take three and stuff like that, you know, literally multi-track, 24-track, 2-inch tape edits. And so a lot of the tracks were actually made up by me in that way by editing. And so once we'd done that, then we would do overdub onto them and stuff. And so a lot of that was done there. But then we had Christmas off, if I remember rightly. And then we moved to this studio that I mentioned before in Canada called Le Studio, which was right out in the country in a ski resort about 100 miles north of Montreal. And that's, I'll describe that drum thing that I was talking about mm-hmm. to be like. So because Stuart and Sting didn't like being in the same room together, it would be sort of, well, Sting would go, for instance, in this instance, Sting would go out skiing in the morning and then he'd come back and we'd have lunch. And then Sting would come in the studio and Stuart would go out skiing in the afternoon. So one day, I think we were working on Every Breath You Take, actually. One of the big problems with Every Breath You Take was that Sting always wanted, well, me included, we always wanted the drums to be incredibly simple on that song because we just wanted it to be as it is. And Stuart, being Stuart and being an incredible drummer as well, wanted to play something more flamboyant on it. And so that was hard enough getting the backing track as it was and ended up in the first place. But anyway, this one day, Sting's out skiing, Stuart comes in the studio, he says, look, I've got this idea to put an overdub hi-hat on it. And it was, I can't remember exactly what the part was, but it was some sort of quite intricate hi-hat part. And so he overdubbed onto it. And me being, you know, the eternal diplomat, said, okay, fine, overdub, you know. I couldn't just say no, even though I was sort of a bit reticent about it. So anyway, we put the hi-hat on and then Sting comes in the studio in the afternoon and Stuart's skiing and he says, well, what did you do this morning? And I said, well, I'm going to have to play you this hi-hat part that Stuart's put on Every Breath You Take. I don't like it, Sting says. And saying, well, don't you want to hear it first? No, I don't like it. So I said, look, it's only fair. I have to play it to you, whatever. And so anyway, I played it. And Sting said, I fucking hate it. Am I right? Am I allowed to say words like that?
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
Okay.
That's because like my kids.
There's a lot of these in the studio. I mean, the whole session, you know. Anyway, what happens is Sting says, I never want to hear that hi-hat again. You've got to erase it now. And don't forget, we're in an analog situation still. So if you erase something off the tape recorder, it went forever. Mm-hmm. The big magnet in the sky, as we used to say. And nowadays, you would just, if you're in Pro Tools or digital, you just take it off what's called the playlist. You know, you never, ever lose anything. And so anyway, he made me erase this hi-hat and he stood by the tape machine with me. He said, I want to see the red light come on that track to see that you are erasing that hi-hat so I never have to listen to it ever again. So I sat there or stood there, put the track into record and it got wiped. So of course, the next time Stuart comes in the studio and we're playing that song, where's my fucking hi-hat? And so then, you know, you can imagine a huge argument would break out. And in the end, I said, well, look, actually, Stuart, I didn't like that hi-hat either. I think the drum track you've put down on the track as it is perfect. And I think to not want to use that terrible old cliche, but less is more. And we don't, you know, we really don't need it. And I think that damaged my relationship with Stuart for several years to come.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, luckily it was sort of towards the end of the album, but I tell you what, in the end, especially the songs on side two, we did an unbelievable job. Well, Sting did an unbelievable job. Well, I think we both did an unbelievable job because a lot of those songs on side two, let me just get them up, were very much produced in the mix, if you understand what I... So the first side of the album, Walking in Your Footsteps, Oh My God, they're more sort of, you know, especially Synchronicity 1 and Synchronicity 2 are more bandy tracks, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas Every Breath You Take, King of Pain, Wrapped Around the Sahara, Wrapped Around Your Finger, rather, those three when we recorded those, they had pretty well everything going all the way through them. And Sting and I both thought, we've got to do something about this. We need a bit more light and shade in them and stuff. And so we basically spent quite a long time on each song every day taking stuff out. In other words, when you're mixing all the songs together, you can mute each channel out individually. So we would mute some of the drums out, like I think Stuart had played the drums through all of it, and I would mute all the drums out apart from the bass drum, which was quite hard to do because you'd have bleed from the other drums onto the bass drum mic or whatever. And so we really constructed those songs, and I'm very proud, particularly of those three songs, of how we got them to be. And so Sting and I very much were involved in the mixing. And by that time, I had, which was why Stuart, I think, I had to take sides in the end. There was no way I couldn't, if you see what I mean. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been there. And without actually saying that to Stuart, I think it became obvious. And you know, Sting wrote those songs. They were great songs. I owed it to Sting and to the record, and as a professional and as a producer, to do the best that we could do on them. You know, actually, it was one of the times where I bonded very well with Sting on those songs. And of course, you know, the mixing of the Synchronicity songs and stuff was, you know, it was great. So it did end up great, but I can remember leaving the studio for the first time with a massive sense of relief. And I think the next album I went on to do was the second album I did with Genesis, I think.
Genesis, yes.
Yeah, to get back to England, to go to work with a band who
like each other,
loved each other, liked each other, and so on, was a massive breath of fresh air and a relief, I think, as well.
Sure.
It was pretty obvious that the Police would, I mean, I know they obviously toured that album, and it was pretty rough on the tour by all accounts as well, although a couple of live shows were recorded from it that again have got a fantastic edge to them. And so it's difficult to knock it. I can't knock it. It's one of the best, you know, I mean, Every Breath You Take is the most played song ever in America, I think.
Yes, incredible, isn't it?
And so, you know, even though there's painful memories from me in it, and probably all the band as well, it's, even though I say it myself, a seminal work, isn't it?
Absolutely. So when you listen to Every Breath You Take on the radio on TV, what do you hear?
I hear... Ooh, I wish I'd done that a bit different, or which is usually what happens.
How would you have improved Every Breath You Take? It's like one of those most perfect records ever made. Yeah. It's just flawless, isn't it? So were those four songs always designed as singles? Because to me, they stand out. Because I think all four of those are equally brilliant. Nothing else on the album can come close to it. Not even Mother can get close to those four songs. Because they're just
Mother.
So were they, because you said you worked so hard on those songs in terms of giving a bit of light and shade, were they always earmarked as like these four songs?
I think so. I kind of think so. I mean, it's pretty obvious Mother wasn't going to be a single.
I have visions of Sting like talking to Stuart and Andy and being like, okay, let's see what you got then. And Andy Summers plays Mother and Sting's like, yeah, go with that one. That's great. There's not going to be any Omega Man issue on this one. Yeah, great, Andy. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, what can you say?
When you first heard Mother,
yeah,
what form was it? Was it a demo? Was it? Did you play
Mother on the album is the demo.
Oh, is it? It's like, I'm not producing that. It's like, just put it straight on.
Well, I mean, he came
Andy up. Is perfect as it is. That's going on the record. Right, next.
Yeah. I mean, normally it was quite difficult to get Sting to sing on either Andy's or Stuart's songs, to be honest. And
Andy wants Sting to sing out of
them. Actually, no, I don't think so. I think I can't remember doing anything with Mother other than mixing it, I think. I'm not sure that any of us did anything on it.
And how did you mix it? What was the how did you create light and shade in it, or just
not really. Not really. I don't. I mean, normally I hate to say that if I do listen to the record, I'd probably skip.
It's kind of the whodunit of the album, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, do you know what? Now, 40-odd years later, or not quite 50 years later, but whatever, 38 years later, it's so bizarre, it's almost good.
Yes, yes. It's like the Revolution 9 thing or something so odd. It's like, well, it's kind of cool in a way. You've got something that weird on an album that's like multi-platinum.
Yeah. It's so out there that it's sort of good, and it was very heartfelt from Andy, weirdly enough. But of course, at the time, from, you know, a record producer's point of view, I just thought it was, you know, I must hope that Andy's not listening to this, because I don't mean to disrespect you, Andy, if you are, but we just thought it was rubbish. And my assistant at the studio in Canada, when we mixed it, he adored the Police, and he said to me at the end of when we finished the record and we were making, you always make sort of safety copies and that sort of thing, and he said, oh, do you mind, I'd really like to have a copy of the album if you don't mind. And I said, well, as long as you don't, you know, as long as it's only for you, I don't mind. And he said, and I'm just going to tell you, I'm going to leave Mother off my version.
So Murder by Numbers is a bonus track on the CD.
Yeah.
Was that ever, because that was an Andy Summers co-writer, that would have got him his songwriting credit. Was there ever any like suggestion about you, Andy, how this is your song? It's a pretty good song.
Do you know the story about it?
No.
Okay, well, the story about it was that we were in Montserrat and we had dinner one night, and for some reason Andy had his guitar just by the dinner table. Maybe we had just finished. And he started to play a chord sequence. And hopefully this story is right, or just about right. He started to play this chord sequence, and Sting said, oi, that sounds quite good. And then he said something like, well, I've got some lyrics that I think might go with that. And I kid you not, 20 minutes later, we went into the studio, recorded that absolutely live, including the vocal, and that is the first take, the first and only take, that song.
So Sting had lyrics that were already written that just happened to go with that tune, yeah. That chord sequence.
Yeah, he worked it out with Andy over a course of just a few minutes. We went in the studio, tuned up, and it was literally the first take. That is, all the drums is completely ad-libbed by Stuart as well. There was no overdub on that or anything. One and only first take.
They could still do it like that. They could still yeah. work together.
Yeah. No, they're amazing. Three-piece bands, when they click, are the best, you know. It's like the Jam, Cream.
Nirvana. So was there any talk of putting that on the album, or was it like he wanted Mother and that was it?
No, I think it only ever went on the CD, didn't it? Because CDs were just coming out. Probably the reason it didn't go on the LP was, again, for a sonic point of view, that we'd run out of groove time, so to speak. There had to be an Andy song on it, and there had to be a pure Andy song.
Because he'd only get 50% of the song otherwise, as opposed to 100%.
Exactly. The last thing about Murder by Numbers is it was actually quite contentious and quite, you know, if you wanted to read something into that lyric, you could. And Sting and I both got letters in the years to come after that record about how irresponsible we were to make a song with those lyrics.
The encouraging murder.
Yeah, I know, it's weird. I mean, people used to write, when Sting had another child, people would write to him saying, what are you doing? You're having too many children, or people will moan about anything.
What's the most surprising thing that someone could know about Sting that they don't? You know, like, does he just do like jammy dodgers, or Has he got the full collection of Bananarama singles or anything like that? Something that would surprise people to know about Sting.
It's quite easy to beat him at tennis.
Oh, he seems so athletic and fit and lithe and like dancing and pogoing around. So, really.
But that's about the only thing he can be beaten at. A very, very competitive guy, whether you're playing chess, cards, or what.
So when you beat him at tennis, does he mope around a bit? And then does it affect his recording in the afternoon? He lays down a really bad baseline because he's still pissed off about that backhand.
Well, he just wouldn't play tennis with you anymore after that.
There's no one to blame but me.
Do you know what? I can remember talking to Sting about when we were making records. This was more latterly in when I worked with him during his solo records and stuff. And what I found very interesting was that he said, I never listened to other music. So the question was, well, why not? I don't want to be influenced. When I say other music, I mean other contemporary music. Mm. He would listen to classical music or whatever. Never listened to other music. So, as I said, he didn't want to be even subconsciously influenced. And then secondly, he never, ever listened to the record that we finished again.
Really?
So once we finished the record, that was it. I mean, he'd play the songs on tour. Mm. He never listened to the record. He said to me once, because we were talking about musical integrity, which I always felt was one of the sort of main things with working with Sting, and I'm very proud of all the stuff I've done with him and solo albums and stuff.
Yeah.
And he said to me, I think it's very important that we grow old gracefully. And not quite sure if he's remembered that actually now. But anyway.
What you're referring to.
So anyway.
He still looks good though, doesn't he? I'd love to, even at the age of 25, I'd love to have the body he's got now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's sickening to be that talented, that good looking, to have that physique at his age. It's annoying.
I know. It is amazing, isn't it? If you've got sort of 100 people working for you and you've never had to cook a meal in your life and you've got...
Put out the rubbish or anything like that, yeah.
Yeah, you've got plenty of time to...
Yeah, look after yourself,
And read books and things like that, because he's very well read. But anyway, that's me being mean.
So last question on the police. What was the worst moment or fight you ever saw with them in the studio?
Well, yeah, the worst fight, I think, used to happen most days, to be honest. I'm not sure if I can remember one over another particularly. I think there were sort of, literally physical fights, but I think they were so used to doing it that it was slightly, I'm not quite sure if the punch was 100%.
A bit handbags, is it? Kind of
slightly
pushing, yeah.
But I mean, there was a famous story, which I wasn't there, but at a gig, apparently a police gig at some point in the early 80s, I think it was, and they were playing in France, outdoor festival, and Sting and Stewart had a fight, and it was quite serious, and Stewart ended up with a cracked or if not broken rib, and he was in terrible pain and couldn't obviously play the gig, and he literally couldn't sit up, let alone play the drums. And so it was like, oh my God, I think the stadium was full of people. No chance of cancelling the gig, or certainly not from Miles Copeland's point of view. And so the great thing with the police was each of the guys, Sting, Stewart and Andy, had their own roadie. And their own roadie was good at playing their instrument. So Sting's roadie was Danny, and Danny could play the bass very well, and Stewart's roadie was Jeff, who was an excellent drummer as well. And so, and this is absolutely true, apparently Jeff played the whole gig, the whole police gig, with a hat sort of rather over his head, and the follow spot, the lighting people told don't light the drums too much, and apparently no one ever knew.
Was he very tall?
He wasn't quite as tall and as lanky as Stewart, but he was probably roughly the same. But he was a very good drummer too.
Oh, that's amazing. You can fill in the Stewart code.
And they used to use the roadies to do the soundtrack sometimes because they could all play the band's songs.
The My Atisography Quick Fire Round.
Best video of one of your songs?
Oh, no.
Remember the time you saw a video to one of your songs? That's a good video. That I like what they've done to our song there.
I haven't seen half of them. Not possible to answer.
Not possible. The one that got away, the track that had potential that you never felt you quite got right.
Well, I don't know if this answers the question, but the song we left off Synchronicity for Mother, which turned up on a soundtrack album, which was called I Burn For You. I adored that song and I was really upset when it wasn't allowed to be on the album.
So was it not allowed because it wasn't the right version, or was it just they just didn't want that song on there?
No, it wasn't the right version. It was just a song had to go, and I thought I was depressed that Mother was there.
And Mother stayed on and not this.
Oh, I Burn For You.
If only Andy Summers had written it. Yeah. Okay, who would... It might be a very obvious question with a very obvious answer, but I'm hoping you'll surprise me here. Who would win the street fight between the Police and Genesis? Because Phil Collins is short, I can imagine he'd be quite a little kind of, he'd get in there, he'd be, you know, he'd have a good low center of gravity, a bit of energy. If he thinks about, you know, if he's in the same mood as he was when he wrote I Don't Care Anymore, we can have a bit of, yeah.
Well, I think that Andy and Tony Banks would have run away. and so.
2v2.
Yeah, 2v2.
Stuart Copeland and Phil Collins squaring up. That's an image.
Yeah, I think it would be a close one, but I still think the Police would probably win.
Legit, because they've had the practice, haven't they?
Yeah.
Years of practice.
Yeah, they have. And Sting's always in the gym as well, so he's
absolutely,
quite...
Yeah.
He'd be able to have the stamina to keep going. Keep
tantric fighting, yeah. Which of those six would you choose as your phone a friend in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Depends what subject. If it was something literary, then I think it would probably annoyingly have to be Sting. If it was music from the 60s through to the 80s, then I would nominate Phil.
Okay, that's good. Biggest professional regret of the 80s?
Probably I wished I'd been able to do more work with Hall & Oates.
Was there ever an option to produce an album with them, or did that just never come up after mixing H2O?
No, I don't know. I can't really remember. I mean, I mixed that record. It was really successful, but I don't know if I was just busy. I don't remember particularly being asked to do an album and me saying no. I think my biggest regret of the 80s is not persuading David Bowie to make a better record than we did when I took over. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Definitely my biggest, what's the word, professional regret. Because I took over the record halfway through, and by which point David had almost not lost interest, but he was a bit pissed off. And I wish I had been more assertive at the time.
How much later on in your career would it have to have been for you to have been that assertive, to have had the experience and the confidence then to be able to say, come on, let's make a better album here?
That's a very good question. Probably, I think I got good at sort of being more assertive at probably late 80s, I suppose.
Late 80s, right.
And the thing is, working with Bowie, when you're working with, you know, heroes like that, I think I would be more assertive. Well,
so if he had come to you and said, like, let's do Tin Machine, you'd be like, no, David, this is crap, write some pop songs, come on, shake the beard. Yeah, you'd have been there.
You know, I did do one song with Tin Machine.
Yes, it's on the second album, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, because that's 90s, I didn't bother looking into that, so.
Yeah, one shot.
Yes.
David Bowie,
he was
I think the best singer I ever worked with, and he was one of the nicest people I ever worked with. He was incredible, and I kind of like I say, I wished I'd been professionally more assertive with him. I'd been able to do more stuff with him, but I was lucky enough to do what I did.
Yeah. Song of yours you'd be glad to never hear again, which is either you hate it or you're sick of hearing it because it's just enough already.
Oh, hold on. I'll tell you exactly. Illegal Alien.
Oh, no. I love that. Okay, best single professional moment of the 80s.
Getting one of my Grammy Awards. I think for No Jacket Required, wouldn't it?
So you got best producer, didn't you?
Yeah, best song and best producer.
So how was that experience then, going to the Grammys and picking up the awards?
Awesome. It was amazing. It was amazing. And I think it was that one I got given by Diana Ross.
Wow.
Diana Ross come up on stage and kiss you and stuff was mighty.
That's fun. Bonus. So where are your Grammys now? Where do you keep them?
They're upstairs. I've got a sort of, I hate to say it, sounds a bit pompous, a trophy.
Do you have any gold disc, platinum discs for all your platinum records that you could have shown Paul McCartney in 1985? Yeah. Take a view in front of them. Said, this is just from the last 3 years. Look, Paul.
Yeah. The walls are full and there's more left over, but that sounds like I'm really bragging.
No, come on, man. And you've earned it.
The Eternal Jukebox.
I'm doing a thing called the Eternal Jukebox where every guest gets to pick three songs from their career that will be saved for all eternity. Which three tracks from the 80s would you save?
Oh, well, I suppose it would have to be In the Air Tonight. You mean my own songs?
Yes, of your own songs.
Okay, it's got to have to be In the Air Tonight, Every Breath You Take, and Senses Working Overtime.
Yeah. Not Mother?
No, sorry.
Okay, and three words to describe your 80s.
Full on work.
End of part two of the interview. Cheers!
So that was part two of the Hugh Padgham interview. I have to say, the echoed sax solo on Maneater, that was genius. That was the end of, like I said before, that was the end of the first interview I did with Hugh. We did over 3 hours and we're still like halfway through 1983. Yeah, I've tried to be stricter with myself since. I don't want to scare any potential future guests by implying that every interview has to be a 7-hour one. That will scare most of them away. The third part, coming next time, that will have, I think, Bowie, Human League, more Genesis, and more Phil Collins. So look forward to that. I'll be out in a few weeks because I've got one more Tears of Fears interview for the Tears of Fears season that I'm keen to get out. And then we'll continue with the rest of Hugh Padgham. And there's a few more guests that I've already interviewed that got lined up after that. So lots of lovely, juicy, gorgeous interviews coming up with some great stuff on it. So please help share this with anyone you think might be interested. Get the word out. Thank you. And thank you for listening. Also in episode one, I forgot to thank Joe of JD Management for helping set up the interview. Open parenthesis. Close parenthesis. So thank you, Joe, with that. It's fantastic and well worth it. And to leave you with, to continue the theme of ending with You Know What I Mean, here's the version by Frida, recently ex of ABBA, produced by Phil and Hugh. Now you decide which is the best version. I don't think we'll be continuing the You Know What I Mean theme in episode 3, unless Bowie did a dodgy cover of it on his Tonight album. I don't think he did. I will check while editing that episode. Anyway, speak soon. Bye.
Just as I thought I made it, you walk back into my life, just like you never left. Just as I learned to be lonely, you're not sure if you're ready. No, but ready or not, you'll take what you got and leave away. wish I could write a love song to show you the way I feel. Seems you don't like to listen, but like it or not,
I'm Mark Goodman. MTV visited with Daryl Hall and John Oates in the studio as they recorded their new album called H2O.
This is Hugh Padgham, and we wanted to work with him, and so we're bringing him into the project to mix the album.
Okay, well, they've got everything recorded on the tape now, and what I have to do is try and make it sound like a record. In other words, mix.
Hey, wait a minute.
You know, what do you do when you're mixing? You put all the different instruments up like we have here, and you can fiddle around and add a little bit more echo. You can all sorts of different devices and things to what's already down on the tape. So, you know, between us, we sort of talk about, well, how about having this sort of echo on the vocal in the verse and changing it to something else in the chorus or something like that. And, you know, it's where you can, you know, you could make this one particular song sound different in a million ways, yeah. You know.
We have to shout above the din of our Rice Krispies. So fed up.